Coming up on Weekend America.
For American soldiers in Iraq, death may be just around the corner. For Iraqi interpreters, it's not much different.
I will never forgive myself if something happened to my family because of me, so I decided to leave Iraq.
An Iraqi flees to safety in America. I'm John Moe. Also this hour, another war zone, Gaza. We look at it by way of the San Francisco Bay Area. That's where Israelis and Palestinians gather in living rooms to talk. We find out what those conversations have been like in recent days. Elsewhere in the Bay Area, they're not talking, they're playing instruments and marching in a funeral procession.
This is a natural process to the community. When they see this band, a lot of these people, they see this band going up and down the streets all the time. They know what's going on.
The Green Street Mortuary Band's mission? To scare off ghosts and comfort people. Weekend America, after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe in St. Paul. So we get these slug lines for our stories here on the show, right? Just so we know what to call them as they come through the reporting and editing and mixing processes. One or two word phrases, shorthand for the stories. And this hour, we have one of the favorite slug lines I've ever seen. Dr. Sofa. I just enjoy reading it in the rundown here. There it is. Dr. Sofa. The story's pretty great, too. Dr. Sofa is who you call when your sofa won't fit through your door. And he does things to your sofa. It's not pretty, but it gets the sofa in there. Because sofas are important. What does your sofa say about you?
My sofa probably says, I wish I'd see more of you.
I don't own a sofa. I've never lived in one place longer than a year.
I do have a love seat.
So we bought this futon solely for how cute it was, and we realized it was quite possibly the least comfortable futon on the face of the planet.
I don't think my love seat really loves me. It loves my cat better.
So I guess what my sofa would say about me is that I probably care more about how I look than how I feel, which is pretty shallow.
Yeah, but it's pretty deep to anthropomorphize your sofa. Those voices came from Minneapolis, Charleston, West Virginia, and Ann Arbor, Michigan. Fighting continues in Gaza as both sides ignore a UN resolution calling for a ceasefire. But the UN isn't the only group trying to broker peace in Gaza. A grassroots effort called Living Room Dialogue is engaging regular Jews and Palestinians living in the U.S. in conversations. Len Traubman started the dialogue group 16 years ago in San Mateo, California, where he lives. Traubman is Jewish. One of the people he eventually invited to attend was Melek Nasser Toda. She's a Palestinian-American whose father fled Palestine in 1948. Nasser Toda has been involved for 10 years, and for 5 years she has helped run a peacemaker camp to bring Jews and Palestinians together. Len Traubman and Melek Nasser Toda, welcome to Weekend America.
Thank you.
Thanks for the invitation.
When violence flares like it has this week in Gaza, what happens in the dialogue group?
Well, in our dialogue group, we have, you know, a lot of heated dialogue, and we, you know, are very in tune with what's happening. It's very important to all of us, but at the same time, we listen to each other, and we really respect each other's opinions.
Len?
This is a 16-year-old Jewish-Palestinian living room dialogue preparing for its 201st meeting in a really tough time with our brothers and sisters and parents and cousins and dear friends, both in Gaza and in Israel. So it's emotional and it's personal. And at the same time, we are not those and have defined ourselves as those who do not go up and down with the headlines. We hold to the vision and to the function of really listening to one another.
But does the tension ratchet up? I mean, presumably there is disagreement, even though you're trying to come together. Does that get more intense in times like these?
You bet it does. And, you know, there's anxiety coming into a meeting like this. But on the other hand, we're decided. And it, like violence itself, you have to pre-decide, because in the moment, it's too much for a human being to decide not to use violence. So we pre-decide. We're about not using violence and about engaging and staying in the room with each other and really learning from each other as opposed to objecting or denying what the other person is feeling or how they see life.
Does it make any difference to the situation thousands of miles away that you're in some living rooms in the Bay Area talking about this? Does it really matter?
They tell us it does. We've inspired people through the camps that Melek is, and we have helped plan and direct, that bring Palestinian and Jewish women and men and youth together. And then they go home and they bring people across borders and help youth bridge and listen to one another. The quality of listening is terrible, you know, all over the Middle East and all over the planet. We're not listening to Earth and we're not listening to one another. And it is the people who come into the dialogue who see that an enemy is one whose story we haven't heard. These are the people who go home and help people sit down and listen to one another, one of the great acts of healing.
Well, and Melek, it seems like it's a great exercise in listening, but have you seen concrete examples of this making any difference in what is a long-standing, kind of intractable situation?
I mean, we've had people in our camps that, you know, were very adamantly against the camps. And when I say the camps, I'm talking about the peacemakers' camps between Jews and Palestinians. We've invited people who were adamantly against speaking to the other until they came to the camp. And then I think, you know, it was an amazing transformation. Some of these people were people in the West Bank who were in Israeli prisons for years and years and were just, you know, so sort of traumatized by the situation. And then they came and they found people that would listen to them and hear them. And, you know, it just was an amazing transformation.
This situation for people, you know, in America watching it seems so hopeless so often. Where do the two of you find hope in this situation?
One thing I'm very excited about is Obama coming in office. I mean, I'm reading his book now, Audacity of Hope, and he talks about how situations are not simple. They're very complex and that we need to bring people together. So that's one thing that's very exciting for me.
Len?
Well, I think in Obama's campaign, he defined it clearly, and that is change does not come from Washington. Change comes to Washington, and the power is with the citizen, and that we can no longer be spectators to government, that this is the citizen century, and that politics is about relationships. We can't want peace and not want relationships, and the dialogue is modeling those new kinds of relationships, even among enemies.
Len Trautman and Melek Nassertoda, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You can find out more about these living room dialogues at weekendamerica.org. When Barack Obama is sworn into office a week from Tuesday, many in Iraq will be watching closely and wondering what Obama will mean for the war there, which is coming up on its six-year anniversary. In those years since the invasion, the U.S. military has relied on Iraqi workers to help with everything from interpreting to construction efforts. Many of those workers have been targeted for their loyalty to the Americans. Over 300 have been killed by insurgents. Many thousands more have fled to neighboring countries with their families. It's estimated that as many as 60,000 Iraqis are in danger because they aided the United States. Reporter Anna King brings us a story of one soldier who's trying to help his Iraqi colleagues.
Soldier Jason Fahler and his friend Mustafa had the same mission when they met in Iraq in 2005. They worked long hours gathering intelligence for high-level U.S. and Iraqi officials fighting the insurgency. But there was one crucial difference. Fahler was an American living in the Green Zone. Mustafa was an Iraqi living without protection. He still doesn't want his last name used. And in Iraq, he took different routes to the Green Zone to avoid being recognized.
So I used to do sometimes shopping, you know, stop by a market and do shopping, and then go take a bus to a different neighborhood, and then from that neighborhood take another bus to work.
Once Mustafa got to the Green Zone, he'd interpret meetings between Iraqi and American officials. As far as Fahler was concerned, Mustafa was part of his band of brothers. He trusted Mustafa with his life. And in the midst of the bloody conflict, they bonded over the fact that both of their wives were pregnant. Mustafa's son was born first on March 12th of 2005. Just 6 months later, it was Fahler's turn to have a son. But things didn't go smoothly.
The night that I learned of his birth was very lonely.
Fahler heard from his sister that the baby was in distress. He was in a large holding tent near the Baghdad airport, waiting for a flight to the U.S. It was dark, and the air smelled heavy of dust. He couldn't call out on his cell phone, so he just had to wait.
It was 3 a.m, so the only thing that there was to keep me company was the sound of two guys snoring in the tent, the hum of a generator and a firefight going on.
When he got the word that his son was healthy, the first person he called was Mustafa.
And we were so happy to hear that. And so we celebrated, actually. We celebrated in the office.
4 months later, Failer was safely back in his home enjoying life with his infant son. But Mustafa was still in Iraq working for the Americans. The insurgents knew who he was and where he lived. He was getting death threats. Once, masked men climbed to the top of his house with guns. Mustafa's wife was home alone with his children. The neighbors shot guns to scare the men away.
I will never forgive myself if something happened to my family because of me. So I decided. I was decisive to leave Iraq.
Failer was determined to help bring Mustafa to safety, but it wasn't easy. At that time, there was as many as 15,000 Iraqi interpreters working for the U.S. and just 50 visa slots. Not only that, Mustafa had to travel to another country to get an interview with a U.S. consulate.
It was obviously a pretty tedious process with a lot of red tape, multiple levels and layers of bureaucracy that we had to navigate, and it took some time.
It took 6 months for Failer to bring Mustafa to the U.S. Then Failer helped Mustafa and his family get settled in a home nearby in Oregon. Failer calls Mustafa a Hulya, which is the Iraqi word for my brother.
The things that I do for you are because you are like my brother. I would do these things for my brother and because I consider you to be my brother.
You are more than my brother. You know, he's like my brother, you know. So as long as I'm alive, I will never stop praying for you guys. And all I can pray for you is health and success and a secure life for you and your son and for all the people you love and for all the good Americans.
Now Mustafa works for the Oregon National Guard, helping soldiers perfect their Arabic. On the weekends, he works in a supermarket deli.
I'm happy here, you know, because I can see my kids right now growing up in a normal environment. And they're ready to adjust, you know. And they already melted in the pot.
After helping Mustafa, Failer founded the Checkpoint One Foundation, named after a gate outside the Green Zone, where several interpreters have been killed. He's since helped about 30 other Iraqi and Afghani interpreters into the U.S. In Portland, Oregon, I'm Anna King for Weekend America.
New legislation has opened an additional 5,000 visa slots for Iraqi interpreters each year for the next 5 years. There are also 50 additional visas for Iraqi or Afghani interpreters. Failer is working to get more visas for Afghani interpreters, but the future of his foundation is in limbo. His Army Brigade might deploy again this year.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
Obama wants to stimulate the economy, Roland Burris wants Obama's old job, and the British are eating squirrels. Don't worry, that last one is unrelated to the first two. Good news, bad news, no news, next on Weekend America. From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. Well, it's been another week chock full of news. 2009 apparently will have just as much news as 2008. Here to sort it into handy categories of good news, bad news, and no news is our esteemed panel. Radio host Luke Burbank. Hello, Luke.
Hi, John.
Lead singer of The Long Winters, John Roderick. Hey, John.
Hey, John.
And columnist Stacey Grenrock Woods. Hello, Stacey.
Hello, John.
On Thursday, Barack Obama announced plans to get the economy back on track. His stimulus package calls for extensive investment in alternative energy in order to create jobs. Expected cost? Over $800 billion. Some Democrats say the tax break in it make for trickle-down economics all over again. Republicans say it's too expensive. What kind of news is this plan? Luke.
I think it's good news because, I mean, will it work? Won't it work from an economic standpoint? I mean, only Warren Buffett and the ghost of Miss Cleo know what will happen. But along the way, as they're, you know, dumping all this money back into the economy and into these projects, I'm glad to hear that they're at least trying to make some environmental changes, you know, green up some of these federal buildings. And even if it doesn't do what it's supposed to do economically, I feel like there will be some lasting environmental improvements that we can look back on. So that's what I mean.
John, this is great news.
Yeah?
This is what I think so. This is what I thought I was voting for. I want solar panels. Isn't this what we wanted? You know, big stimulus, people getting jobs and greening up the whole place?
But over $800 billion. This is a lot of cash to lay out in a cash-strapped society. It's kind of a leap of faith, don't you think?
Yeah, but it's just going to come from super rich people. Who cares?
Which there are none left, thanks to Bernie Madoff. Right. I'm not even kidding.
In the long run, we're not even going to remember this economic downturn. We're not going to remember the money that it costs to implement this project, because in the long term, this is a necessary step for us as a culture. Ultimately, we're going to have to find a way to make more energy from somewhere.
All right. This week, Roland Burris, the man appointed by impeached Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich, showed up on the first day of the new congressional session. He presented his credentials to be sworn in as the new junior senator from Illinois, but was turned away when his papers lacked the Illinois Secretary of State's signature, as well as the Great Seal of the state of Illinois. As the week went along, however, it appeared Burris may eventually be seated. What kind of news was Roland Burris and the Roland Burris show this week? Stacey?
I'd say no news, but funny.
Yes.
Yeah. Hilarious, in fact. But no news, no. He's weird. He'll probably be there for 2 years, right? And then that'll be it. We'll never notice him, and then he'll be gone.
As an Alaskan, I'm not really qualified to cast any aspersions or throw any stones against the political culture of the state or the great state of Illinois. But it seems like no news.
I think it's good news, actually, in particular how it's been playing out now this week, because it confirms one of my feelings, and that is that the most powerful force in our universe is awkwardness.
Mm.
It drives almost everything. When Roland Burris was still in all the way over in Chicago, all the people in the Senate, particularly Democrats, were like, oh, my God, if he comes over here,
oh.
I say this as having a 14-year-old daughter.
He sounded a little bit like Rosie Perez.
Oh, my God, Becky, if that guy comes over here, we are totally going to be like, get out of here. And then he smartly shows up at the Senate without officially, you know, having the okay to be there. And then all of these people that were making these very intense and grandiose statements about how he was not going to be allowed there. Then they were like, oh, hey, Roland. And then like in the cafeteria, and then everyone was just kind of being fake nice to each other. And now by the end of the week, it was like, if you want him to go home so bad, you tell him. He's fine. He's pretty nice. And then now they're just like, okay, he can be here. The power of awkwardness. No one wants to send him home because it's awkward.
Okay, last topic. There are too many gray squirrels in England and not enough red squirrels in England. So here's what they did. The British have decided to begin a concerted effort to kill and eat more gray squirrels. The New York Times reported this week that it's catching on among gourmets. They say it's like oily rabbit. Squirrel eating, good news, bad news, or no news?
This is bad news. Why can't they just relocate the squirrels Or what about what they do with feral cats? Gather them up and sterilize them. You can't eat something that cute. And anybody who disagrees with me, would really, in your Christmas stocking, would you rather have a puppy or an eel? You know, we do treat the cute animals better because they are cute, and that is our nature, and it's survival of the cutest.
If I opened my Christmas stocking and had an eel and a puppy in there, wow.
What kind of childhood did you have, Stacey?
Well, I didn't have any Christmas stockings because I had the misfortune of being born Jewish.
Oh, that is a misfortune.
So this is how she imagines Christmas to be. You sometimes receive eels.
That's what your mom told you so you wouldn't be sad about it.
That actually sounds like an intriguing sushi menu. Eel and puppy.
For me, the whole thing with eating meat is it's a daily, almost hourly exercise in disassociating from what I'm actually doing. If I can block it out with, a cow or even a chicken or lamb, I can throw down with a gray squirrel.
That's the news of the week. Now it all makes sense. Panel, thank you.
It was our pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks, John.
Luke Burbank is a former reporter for NPR. He hosts the radio show Too Beautiful to Live in Seattle. Stacey Grenrock Woods is a sex advice columnist for Esquire magazine and author of I, California. John Roderick is the lead singer for The Long Winters. They have a new DVD out, Live at the Showbox. Great cover of a Chicago song on that one. And one last item, Rod Blagojevich. The guy's been bad news for fans of Honest Government, but good news for fans of political theater, because he does things differently than politicians ever do. Not just the hairstyle or, as prosecutors allege, pretty much saying on tape, "I am accepting bribes." He also quotes poetry. On Friday, Blagojevich chose to go jogging while the Illinois legislature voted to impeach him. And when he next spoke to the press, he quoted Tennyson. He knew it by heart. "Though we are not now that strength which in old days moved earth and heaven, that which we are, we are. One equal temper of heroic hearts made weak by time and fate, but strong in will to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield." And it turns out quoting poetry is a regular thing for him. When he got busted in December, he busted out some Kipling at a press conference. "If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you but make allowance for their doubting too, if you can wait and not be tired by waiting or being lied about, don't deal in lies, or being hated, don't give way to hating." And that's as far as he got. He kind of trailed off. The rest of the poem is about overcoming adversity to eventually own the world and become a man. When poetry is used in politics, it's often to reflect on something good. Blagojevich uses it defensively to kind of say, "I'm awesome." So bad news for Tennyson and Kipling that they've been co-opted into all this. Good news for anyone who enjoys one of the more fascinating political meltdowns in recent memory.
Weekend America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
Got a sofa that just won't fit into your house? Don't give up. Call Dr. Sofa. He doesn't have a doctorate, really. It's more like Dr. Pepper or Doctor Who. Still, it helps. Ahead on Weekend America. Thank you. From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. In Washington, D.C., the talk now is all about the inauguration. Will all the people expected on the Mall actually fit? Will the Metro be able to carry all the crowds? Security is going to be tight. No strollers or backpacks in the areas closest to the Capitol. But it's going to be a big party as well as a big headache for the district. And somewhere in that crowd will be B.J. Hill. He's come a long way to get there, 4,000 miles on foot. As you may suspect, he's on a mission. Reporter Sean Hurley has been checking in with him along the way.
I read about B.J. Hill back in 2006. He'd walked across Massachusetts, collecting handwritten messages for the governor in a notebook. And then he brought the notebook back to Boston.
And later on, I actually did get the chance to meet with the new governor, Governor Deval Patrick, and got 10, 15 minutes to in his office to hand the books over.
On March 1st, BJ set out to do the same thing on a much larger scale. He flew to San Francisco and began to walk east. It's kind of an old-fashioned idea, even a little strange. Collecting messages for the president? Isn't that what the internet's for? How would a book of scrawled notes help the president more than, say, the latest opinion poll?
I think it would keep him grounded as to, you know, what the rest of us Americans really are thinking and what we're doing and what we're going through.
BJ has traveled the world, teaching English in China, Japan, and Afghanistan. He manned the phones for the Red Cross after 9/11. He likes to try new things, but he had a lot of trouble with the handheld recorder I sent him.
All right, I'm BJ Hill, and today is May 16th, 2008.
But it wasn't too long before he was sending back good recordings. And as he traversed the country, he began to ask people to read their messages into his recorder.
Number one priority, in my opinion, is to stop the occupation of Iraq, and instead of killing people, talk to them, feed them, and talk peace instead of war. Love and hope to you. Kate Chalk, Rock Springs, Wyoming.
We need better health care for self-employed, and I can't say enough about the gas prices.
They got to do something about these oil prices because some people, it's either eat or you need heat.
Today is August 21st, and I am sitting in Anna, Illinois, with Fran Jaffe. Fran, can you read your message to the president?
Dear Mr. Obama, I am hopeful for the future. However, this nation needs a representative who can put power and ego behind and truly try to do what is best for the people.
Did you notice there that Fran addressed her message, Dear Mr. Obama, back in August?
Even when Hillary Clinton was still in the race, I found that a lot more messages were addressed to Barack Obama than to anyone else. So it really wasn't a surprise to me when Barack Obama actually won.
BJ's been on the road now for 11 months. He's walked more than 4,000 miles. He's gone through 8 pairs of shoes. He's pitched his tent behind churches, in open fields, in the woods.
I've been to a rodeo in Nebraska, for example. I've been to the library in Salt Lake City. I've been to senior citizen centers in Nevada. Powwows, again, in Nebraska. You know, anywhere that I was going to be, that there was going to be a group of people, I try to get in there and, you know, and kind of introduce myself.
This week, BJ finally comes home. But not for long. On January 20th, he'll enter the U.S. Capitol for the inauguration of President Obama. He's got a ticket, and he'll bring his 3 well-traveled, leather-bound books with him to Washington.
You know, I started this project, and it's not going to finish until I see it through, until they're actually in his possession. Then I'll know that my walk is done.
I've gotten to know BJ pretty well over the last year, and I don't think he'll give up until the books are in the president's hands. He's nothing if not persistent. And if I might just put my own note down here, Dear President Obama, please see BJ Hill about an important matter involving the people of the United States. I'm Sean Hurley for Weekend America.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
It's Weekend America from American Public Media. I'm John Moe. Tickets to the Obama inauguration are awfully hard to come by. Traveling to D.C. is kind of a hassle, so many of us will just watch on TV. It's going to be a huge event, of course. Poet Linda Paston is planning to catch the ceremony from the comfort of her couch, just as she did almost 50 years ago when she curled up to watch the inauguration of President John F. Kennedy.
I was a young mother with children of 2 and 4, and so there was no way that I could get downtown for Kennedy's inauguration, but I was pinned to the television that whole day.
We observe today.
The children running around in the background were unable to even distract me. We were so excited to have this young, vibrant new president.
Signifying renewal as well as change. For I have sworn before you and
for me, the
God,
most vivid part of the inauguration was not the swearing in. It was
first the dedication.
Watching Robert Frost.
Summoning artists to participate in the august occasions of the state seems something for us all to celebrate. And
watching that very old man with the wind just blowing the paper out of his hands and him stumbling up there, it was excruciating.
This tribute to be his that here I bring is about... No, I'm not having a good life here, Carl.
When I watched Frost stumbling over his words in that crowd in front of the whole world, he couldn't get his glasses on properly. This may be wrong, is how I remember it, however. And to see someone who you've admired and respected and revered for your whole life, it's a very terrifying and sad thing.
Founding sages, God gave his approval of.
Finally, I think the paper just either blew out of his hands or in the wind with his hair in his face, he couldn't read. And what he did was to recite one of his best poems.
The land was ours before we were the land. She was our land more than 100 years before we were her people. She was ours in Massachusetts and Virginia. But we were England's, still colonials, possessing what we still were unpossessed by what we now no more possess.
The land was ours before we were the land is a poem that I had studied and known for many years. And it was so appropriate to an inauguration because it was a poem about a kind of patriotism. We belong to the country. We have to, even in the moments when we despair of the way it's behaving, it's still, we belong to it. I wrote my poem because somebody asked me to write a poem about Frost. And what came to me immediately was that memory of him at the inauguration. Remembering Frost at Kennedy's inauguration. Even the flags seemed frozen to their poles, and the men stamping their well-shod feet resembled an army of overcoats. But we were young and fueled by hope. Our ardor burned away the cold. We were the president's, and briefly the president would be ours. The old poet stumbled over his own indelible words, his breath, a wreath around his face, a kind of prophecy. Even though I wasn't out in the cold almost came out of the television set. Everyone's breath was a cloud around their face, not just Frost's. And when you're speaking and your breath comes out, it is kind of like a wreath around your face. And I immediately thought of a funeral wreath. Frost would not live very much longer after that year. When I say that briefly the president would be ours, it was because it was such a short time that we had him. We didn't know then that it was going to be so brief.
Linda Paston's latest book of poetry is Queen of a Rainy Country. The poem she read, Remembering Frost at Kennedy's Inauguration, is in that book. It's also at our website, weekinamerica.org. If you're in Boston this weekend, you can stop by the John F. Kennedy Library and catch an exhibit about the Kennedy Inauguration called Poetry and Power. Weekends are moving days, and there are a lot of ways you can do that. There's the old U-Haul truck and a bunch of friends who you pay with pizza and beer method. I found that that worked a lot better when I was younger and all my friends were younger and their spines were stronger and their calendars were looser. After a while, you know, you try to pull that and you just get some dirty looks and some tips for professional movers. That's the other option. Call in the pros, burly men with their own trucks and their trusses. However you choose to move, it's challenging, no matter what you do, especially when it comes to furniture. Big sofas, small doorways, you do the geometry. It's an especially daunting challenge in New York City, where steep stairs and narrow entrances can make it literally impossible to move stuff in. But reporter Sally Hership says there is a solution if you've got the stomach for it.
It's moving day, and there are problems. John Howard is shuttling his family and all their worldly possessions from one Brooklyn apartment to another. The movers are here. There are cardboard boxes and tape everywhere. There's just one thing stopping them.
So everything is set. We've signed our new lease, and then we're sitting here.
On the sofa?
We were sitting on the sofa, oddly enough, just about 3 weeks ago. We had the epiphany that, wow, the sofa does not fit out the apartment.
Since they brought in the sofa, they've remodeled. And now it won't fit out the door. In New York City, real estate prices are big, but apartments are small. While John Howard is struggling to move out, over in Queens, Eileen Graziano is trying to get her couch in. She just arrived from Manhattan when she realized her couch wouldn't make it up her stairs.
I can't say it on the radio. I can't say it. I was not happy.
You should know these are normal-sized couches we're talking about. You know, big enough to seat a family and maybe a dog. It's the old brownstones and subdivided apartments of New York City that have small doorways and steep staircases. They're not exactly couch-friendly. But people love their furniture. It seems that sofas can pack a lot of sentiment between the cushions. John Howard again.
My wife quickly reminded me that this sofa has a lot of sentimental value for us.
She reminded you.
Yes, which then, of course, I remembered.
Yeah, we got it like 5 years ago when we first moved in, and you know, it was like the first element to start to define our interior decor.
So it really tied the room together. For Eileen Graziano, her sofa was a symbol of independence.
And this was the first purchase I made after I got divorced, so it's like mine. And I was really upset that they couldn't get it upstairs. I really was. I was a little heartbroken.
Luckily, there's a savior who can help during these dark times. It's Dr. Sofa, a.k.a. Greg Gomez and Mario Quito to the rescue. And that means...
What's that?
The machine to cut the wood.
The saw.
You feel nice when you cut the saw.
You feel good?
Yeah, I like to cut.
That's right. In order to save these sofas, they're going to be cut to pieces. And you're going to pay about $300 for the privilege. First, you take out staples and remove the fabric. Next, out comes whatever's holding the furniture together. Screws, rivets. And finally, it's time for the back or the arms to come off. To do that, you need the big guns.
Oh my gosh. Yikes. This is a little alarming because, seriously, that's our arm. No, but this is ripped.
The Howard sofa has been completely taken apart. It's almost like watching an autopsy.
Fairly benign experience until they pull out the bone saw.
The movers pack up the Howard sofa. Well, the pieces. It'll get put back together later inside their new place. Back in Queens, Eileen Graziano is pleasantly surprised. Her her sofa, which was also ripped apart, now looks as good as new.
Voila.
You have your couch back. How do you feel?
Now I'm complete, because that's what was supposed to be.
In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Weekend America.
Stacey Grenrock Woods, who's one of our panelists on Good News, Bad News, No News, tells me the Santa Ana winds are now blowing in Southern California, which apparently means increased visibility and increased chance of everyone acting all crazy. For more weather and activity around the country, here's Jeannie Yandel.
Making a snow cave sounds like a bad idea because it's not that far off from a snow cave inn. Baldwinsville, New York teaches the right way to make a winter shelter at Build a Snow Cave. 33 and cloudy to carve out snow caves with small plastic shovels. If this sounds like a lot of work, you're right, it is. Later, Baldwinsville shows its documentary Suckers Digging in the Snow for Hours with Beach Toys. Rubber Band Man and Tail Slides are not moves you do to win at Twister. They're aeronautical feats airplanes perform at Upland, California's Air Show. Sunny in 68, so bring sunglasses to watch stunt pilots do torque rolls and engine off loops. Also, skydiving and parachute teams who I hope are not falling through the sky while planes are getting all acrobatic. Otherwise, Upland, I suggest you rename this event the Air and Ambulance Show. Certainly you've heard the adage, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. Bloomsburg, Pennsylvania tests the veracity of that saying at Old Dogs New Tricks Day. 37 and rainy to literally watch old dogs try to learn new tricks. Afterwards, Bloomsburg will be leading horses to water, herding cats, and measuring the relative worth of one bird in the hand versus two in some kind of shrubbery. For more information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm Jeannie Yandel for Weekend America.
True, the guest of honor never appreciates their work all that much, but the Green Street Mortuary Band is a much beloved institution nonetheless. Hear them next on Weekend America. From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. Even in the best of times, it's hard to make a living as a working musician. Gigs can be few and far between, and they often don't pay well or don't pay at all. In San Francisco, reporter Julie Kane met up with some of the best musicians in the city who pay their rent by scaring off ghosts.
It's a cold, foggy morning in San Francisco, and we're in the basement of a funeral home, right next to where they store the urns. The room is crowded, bustling with activity, but instead of mourners, we're surrounded by trombones, trumpets, and a pale green bass drum painted with pink flowers. Bleary-eyed jazz players, up much earlier than they're used to, mingle with musicians who normally play for the symphony and the ballet. Zachariah Spellman is a tuba player for the San Francisco Opera.
And this is a double B-flat sousaphone. Weighs about 32 pounds.
And this is the Green Street Mortuary Band. Every weekend, rain or shine, they march in military formation through the streets of San Francisco, playing dirge-like Christian hymns for Chinese funerals.
Abide with me, amazing grace, eternal Father.
That's John Coppola, who turns 80 this year. He's a jazz man who's played with the best of them.
God of our fathers.
We're sitting directly across from the mortuary in an Irish pub at the intersection between the Italian neighborhood and Chinatown. It's exactly this patchwork of cultures that has made the Green Street Band such a San Francisco institution. It all began in the early 1900s when a group of young Chinese immigrants first heard an Italian marching band parading through their neighborhood. They wanted to learn to play too and formed their own band. By the 1960s, the band expanded to include professional musicians from all backgrounds. It had become a steady paying gig that everybody wanted in on. Today's funeral is starting, and the Green Street Band lines up in front of the mortuary, getting their sheet music ready and pulling on their trademark gold-braided white ship captain's hats, relics from China's history of British colonial rule. None of the members is Chinese. A hearse is backed up to the door of the mortuary, and a group of saffron-robed monks emerge from the chapel, ringing bells and chanting. It's the cue the band has been waiting for. The coffin is carried outside and loaded into the back of the hearse. Big sticks of incense burn, and mourners take their final bows.
First bow, second, third.
This is a very sacred thing that we're doing here, you know, trying to offer some comfort, something to the families that are suffering right now, but also to recognize this is a natural process to the community. When they see this band, a lot of these people, they see this band going up and down the streets all the time. They know what's going on.
It's an ancient tradition. The music keeps the spirit of the newly deceased close to the body until burial. Hiring a band is also a way for the family to show their status and to announce the passing of a member of the community. Family members in a waiting black convertible hold up a large photo of the deceased framed with brightly colored flowers. Although the band members don't know who has died, when they see that picture, they know it's time to get to work. The tuba player hefts his instrument onto his shoulders, and mortuary workers on motorcycles rev up to guide the procession through traffic.
Well, I hope you enjoy the music.
I know I will.
Some mean cats are playing today. Okay, here we go.
The band begins their solemn march. The picture car drives slowly behind them, followed by the hearse and long lines of mourners in their cars. For musicians, the Green Street Mortuary Band is one of the most coveted gigs in town. It's on the weekends and it's during the day, so it doesn't conflict with nighttime jobs. And it's steady work. There are usually at least two or three funerals every weekend. Darren Johnston, a jazz trumpet player and band leader, says the funeral band helps him survive as a working musician.
Yeah, it's a substantial percentage of my income. And there's months where work is really slow, and then there's a bunch of funerals, and I'm very thankful for them, you know?
The procession moves through densely packed streets. Tourists take pictures, people peer out of the windows of city buses, some men remove their baseball caps.
They think, oh my gosh, look, we're in Chinatown, here comes a parade.
That's Cindy Collins, a trumpeter who plays classical music with the Oakland Civic Orchestra. We round a corner, getting ready to climb one of San Francisco's famously steep hills.
So, yeah, you'll be a full-fledged band member once we get up there.
We've changed direction slightly so that we can pass by the house of the deceased. It's a common ritual, a last visit meant to help the spirit transition from this world and into the next.
They're going to throw the paper or money in the air, and it's just a beautiful sight.
It's called buying the road, a diversion for unfriendly ghosts, and a way for family members to provide for the material needs of their dead ancestor in the spirit world. At the end of the gig, some of the musicians sip beers back at the Irish bar. The job has given them a sense of camaraderie that's hard to beat.
I never thought I'd say that I prefer a funeral band to a symphony orchestra, but there's something about this band. Even though it comes from a sad moment, it's this triumphant moment for the person who's going on, and we're sharing that with the community, and what gets better than that?
In San Francisco, I'm Julie Kane for Weekend America.
If you're in San Francisco this weekend, you might get a chance to see the Green Street Mortuary Band. They're a fixture there. Beat poet Lawrence Ferlinghetti even memorialized them in a poem. We'll leave you today with a few lines. Oompa, oompa goes the band, very slow with the trombones and the tuba and the trumpets and the big bass drum. And the corpse hears nothing or everything. And it's a glorious autumn day in Old North Beach. If only he could have lived to see it. Only we wouldn't have had the band, who half an hour later can be seen straggling back, silent along the sidewalks, looking like hungover, broken-down Irish bartenders, dying for a drink or a last hurrah. And that's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. Our program is produced with Ben Adair, Sasha Aslanian, Julia Barton, Rob Byers, Desiree Cooper, Hillary Frank, Sam Keenan, and Michael Raphael. Also Chrissy Clark, Brendan Noonan, Michael May, who's playing in a marching band and celebrating his birthday this weekend, Ocean Kalen, Ariel Kitsch, Angela Kim, Mark Sanchez, going to a birthday pie party. No gifts, just pies. And Chris Wieg, our intern who's looking at FBI jobs this weekend. The FBI is hiring 2,100 people, seriously. Our theme music was created by Galactic. Our executive producer is Peter Clowney. Jim Russell created the show. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
Hi, this is John Moe, host of Weekend America. The weekends are for sweet reminiscences.
What I decided was that I would never have a favorite song, and that instead I would hate all music forever.
You know, I don't like Hall & Oates anymore. That's how much I did not enjoy that situation.
We're making new memories, so you can go ahead and forget those old ones. Join us for the next Weekend America.